From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And let's get straight to the point. Parents, families, educators, you know you are already asking yourself, will there be school this fall? What will it be like? What do masks and social distancing look like for, say, second graders? And what am I going to do if school does not open up completely? Can we handle another year of remote learning or even a sometimes remote, sometimes at school hybrid? Well, schools are at the heart of a child's life, and they're at the heart of community life in American cities and towns. So these are hugely important questions, and we'd like to start tackling them. This hour on Point, in just a couple of months, what will school be? What should it be? Well, we're going to start today in Ithaca, New York, with Luvell Brown. He is the superintendent of the Ithaca City School District in New York. He was the 2017 New York State Superintendent of the Year. And he's also the moderator of Discovery Education's Equity Talks, a weekly webinar with educational leaders. And we spoke to Superintendent Brown in April. Superintendent, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, thank you, Meghna, for having me back on. It's an honor to be here.
So I am going to ask you about what you think school might be in a couple of months. But before I do that, how have the last 2 months been in Ithaca?
Well, thanks for asking. It has been challenging, but also at times very exciting and liberating. We are doing things we've never done before. Our communities have rallied. Our educators are doing amazing things. We're connecting with young people in ways we have not connected before. So yes, we all are in the midst of significant challenges, but we are all doing things new and for the benefit of our young people.
Can you give me some examples? Because I remember the last time we talked, you had said that, you know, there were maybe differing opinions between different groups of parents or educators about sort of like how quickly could you ramp up something that at least looked like school even remotely?
Yeah, we've continued to focus on the social emotional health of our young people and families. So constant communication with families. We've connected with every single family. We provided access to the internet for families who needed that. So that's been important just to connect and say hello and ask how are you doing. And our instructional processes have evolved. You know, initially it was about just sending home worksheets. Now we've evolved to provide asynchronous and synchronous learning opportunities for young people. We're in the Google Meets. We have young people participating in a culturally responsive way. So our instructional program has evolved. And we'll continue to get better in the digital space. So a lot of changes have happened over the last 2.5 months.
You know, it felt to me that when schools closed in so many places, including Ithaca, the first response, and this is completely understandable, I went through it myself, was shock, right? Because it was such a sudden break from the norm for entire communities. And so when you're in a state of shock, you cling to the familiar, right? That's what gives you comfort and hope of what is familiar. So maybe it made a lot of sense that a lot of people were saying, can we just recreate school online? Since then, have you seen a change in attitude? Is there sort of a willingness to innovate in different ways that you didn't see a couple of months ago?
I'm seeing it all. As I mentioned back in April, I'm seeing folks who wish to return to the traditional approaches. Quite frankly, many folks who have had very good experiences in schools. But I'm also seeing folks who've been traditionally marginalized in our spaces excited about now and the possibilities. So I'm continuing to see the range. We will not go back to where we were before. And folks are mourning that. But there are many, many other folks who are excited about the possibilities.
Okay, so when you say you will not go back to where you were before, what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, the traditional model, the standardized model in a bricks and mortar building completely, that's a thing of the past. And I've been asking for that kind of shift for a long time. We need to be in a blended environment. We need to provide more voice and choice and to cater to individual family preferences. There are some families who wish to have a completely online experiences. We as a public institution should be providing that. There are some families who need to be in person all day, every day, and we need to provide that too. And we'll get into this later, but along that continuum, we need to be speaking with families and offering them those opportunities based on their preferences. So that's where we should be versus the standardized model that, quite frankly, has worked for many folks, but has not worked for many others as well. So we need to provide this kind of voice and choice, differentiated opportunities, and a more culturally responsive and equitable experience, which is where we're having some very rich discussions right now.
Yeah. So this is, and I want to hear more about that in particular in just a second, but Superintendent, this is so fascinating. So are you saying that, I mean, this would be a miracle, so I'm not expecting it to happen, but if the guidance came from public health officials that, you know, school could just reopen, that you could just open doors again and have it be like it was before, that is not what would happen in Ithaca?
Yeah. And we have some capacity to build, yes. And there are negotiations we must have with our employees and our community. We have to communicate much. But let me go back. Schools, as they existed, have traumatized young people. It traumatized me. It traumatized many of my friends. Many of my friends aren't here anymore because of the trauma we experienced in school. That model has been the same for centuries. Shame on us if we don't use this opportunity to address the inequities and the things we've done to the young people in this country for centuries. So yes, in our school district, and because of this amazing Board of Education I have and the community that is very supportive of us being innovative in this way, we will use this opportunity to do more to provide equity, culturally responsive education, and a more inclusive education. We will not re-traumatize our babies and have them come back in the fall and say, here we are, back to normal. And while we're at it, how about we give you a diagnostic assessment, a standardized one, to see how many gaps you have. See, that model, which I'm hearing from a lot of folks across our country right now, won't do much but to further traumatize those who have always been marginalized in our buildings.
Okay. Oh, this is so fascinating, Superintendent. So I want to come back to that because it's going to take a little more time than we have in the remainder of the segment, because the question I wanted to ask you is, well, then what are you going to do instead? But hold on.
Yeah, I got you.
Because I want to bring into the conversation another voice here. Dimitri Christakis joins us from Seattle. Dr. Christakis is a pediatrician and an epidemiologist and the director of the Center for Child Health, Behavior, and Development at Seattle's Children's Research Institute. He's also the editor-in-chief of the Pediatrics Journal of the American Medical Association. And earlier this month, he co-authored an op-ed in that journal that's titled "School Reopening: The Pandemic Issue That Is Not Getting Its Due," and we have an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. Dr. Christakis, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So first of all, tell us, this sounds like a gauche question, but what is so important about school reopening that you think makes it deserve a lot more attention than it's getting?
Well, you know, it's a very loaded question. There's so much to say about it. Yeah. It starts with the idea that schools are children's work. They're essential to their cognitive, social, and emotional development. And part of what we're doing is treating this decision, in fact, in too binary a way. The whole idea of opening schools or not opening them lumps everyone into the same bucket, whether they're in kindergarten or high school seniors, whether they have resources at home or not, whether they have special needs or not. And I think that's grossly unfair in many respects, most notably because the whole idea of distance learning, such as it is, and I applaud the superintendent for how quickly he and others across the country transitioned to something that nobody had foreseen and nobody had planned for, to try to deliver that. But the whole idea of that, providing an adequate education for primary school kids, for children with special needs, really strains credulity. I don't think anybody believes that primary school children can meaningfully engage and learn through and get all that they need from schools via a Zoom approach. And that has serious consequences. We know, for example, that the single best predictor of high school graduation is third grade reading. So if children are on grade level at third grade, they're very likely to graduate high school. If they're not at grade level, they're likely not to graduate high school. And if we take the approach that we're not going to return to some level of normalcy in teaching our children until we can ensure that schools are completely safe, I think we're realistically looking at two additional years of children not being back at school. So that would mean 2.5 years of distance learning for elementary school students. And they're not going to be at grade level. Many of them are not going to be at grade level when they otherwise would have been if they had been in a school environment. So we're not going to see the effects of this immediately, but we will see them eventually, and it'll have significant consequences for our society.
So that's under just to be clear, that's under a sort of all or nothing scenario, right? Either schools are open or not open, as long as the question of safety is in the air. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there are many dimensions to it, right? That's part of it. I mean, one of the problems is, yes, we're thinking about this monolithically and asking should schools open or not. And we're not thinking about sort of the innovative approaches that we could take or the hybrid approaches we could take to try to maximize educational opportunities, particularly for certain subpopulations of children. Absolutely. But my personal belief is that we should start with the expectation that children will go back to school, and then reason backwards from how do we make that happen as safely as possible. There's going to be risk associated with it. There's no question. But there's clear risk associated with kids not going back to school. We know a few things about this virus, and we're learning more every day. We know, really, with pretty good evidence base now, that children themselves are at very, very low risk of serious consequences of this disease. And I say that even in light of the new sort of inflammatory disease that is getting a lot of attention in the media, that too is very, very rare. What we don't know for sure is how important they are in the transmission of the virus. The assumption that was made when we closed schools summarily was that that they're an important vector, as they are with other infectious diseases, notably influenza. But the emerging data now suggests that children actually transmit the virus with much less frequency than adults do, and that their risk of being an important vector may be low.
Right. So Dr. Christakis and Superintendent Brown, stand by for just a moment. We are talking about what school might look like come fall. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about what school might look like in the fall. And we're joined today by Luvell Brown. He is the superintendent of the Ithaca City School District in New York. And we're also joined by Dr. Dimitri Christakis. He's a pediatrician and epidemiologist and director of the Center for Child Health, Behavior and Development at Seattle's Children's Research Institute. And Dr. Christakis, before the break, you were talking about the risk associated with children going back to school. But you had also said there's also a risk of children not being in school, a risk to children of not being in school. Can you elaborate on that? What are those risks?
Yeah, I think they're risks to all aspects of their development. Let's start with their mental health, which isn't getting enough attention. We know from data out of Wuhan that they saw 20 to 30% increase in anxiety and depression in kids that were locked down and kept out of school. We're starting to see that here in the United States. Data are still being collected, but I expect we're going to see a rise in that. We know that children, we already know that children just from the summer lose some educational milestones when they return in the fall. Estimates are 3 to 6 months. I think predictions here are that kids will lose 6 to 9 months. Children, particularly low-income children, will lose 6 to 9 months when they come back in the fall. And then for young children in particular, the social, the peer interactions is so essential to their development. A virtual play date does not meet the needs of a toddler or a preschooler or a kindergartner. It just doesn't. They need to engage in physical play. They need to do peer negotiation. They need to engage in imaginative play with their friends. And they can't do that in any meaningful way over a Zoom chat.
So we're talking about the impact of not being in school on the whole child, right? Not just the academic part of the child, but the child's mental, social, emotional development. Superintendent Brown, you've been listening very patiently here to Dr. Christakis. What are you thinking as you hear him?
Yeah, much. And I'm reflecting on how language is important. I'm hearing much about, you know, when we go back to school or, you know, from us, school never stopped. Our buildings may have been closed, but school continued. Now, albeit it's been in a bit of a crisis mode the last 2.5 months, but over time, we're going to be out of a crisis and we're going to be evolving into a new approach to teaching and learning. Notions of grade level, that's, for me, grade level is a construct. Like many of our policies, this notion of a grade level indication has been an oppressive policy that has not benefited all young people. So I'm looking forward to us rethinking everything from when we re-enter our buildings, when we evolve to the next iteration of K-12 public education, maybe we don't talk about whether or not a kid is on quote unquote grade level. We talk about where they are and how we can provide the support to have them learn and evolve and fall in love with literacy again. Maybe we don't assess in a way to predict whether or not they will graduate, or as we've done in this country, we assess at third grade their reading level to determine how many of them may go to jail or how many prison beds we build. So I'm looking forward to us rethinking all of these conversations, quite frankly, the language we use to talk about how our structure will be rebuilt and organized.
So point taken. And in fact, that's what this moment gives us, that opportunity to do, is to reimagine, right, Superintendent Brown? But I was also, in addition to that, I think Dr. Christakis is saying something that's important and might be resonating with a lot of families right now, and that is school provides a wholeness of life and experience. And all your very well-considered criticisms, absolutely point taken. But whatever school will be or might be, whatever we evolve to, it's still a central part of a child's life that provides really critical supports and experiences.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that the lack of that, of the totality of that, has had an effect on children over the past couple of months.
Of course, and we're seeing it. The teacher relationship, the relationships we have with young people in those face-to-face environment has been so critical, and our young people are yearning for that connection again. So yes, we must get back together, not just our young people, but our communities. We have adults who are hurting as much as our young people right now. Hurting adults hurt young people. As communities, we need to get back together. We need to return to our building. We need to return to the in-person conversations. But I'm asking, when we do that, we have a different perspective and a mindset that's much more inclusive and equitable and loving.
Yeah. Yeah. So Dr. Christakis, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't disagree with much of what Superintendent Brown said. I also want to address kind of a very, very practical role that schools play that's not getting much attention either, which is that there's an enormous focus on getting people back to work, getting adults back to work. That's sort of the tip of the spear, if you will, of most states' policies, most cities' policies right now. But lost in that is that for many parents, getting back to work is impractical, if not impossible, without their children being at school. So in some ways, our priorities are backwards. We really first need to figure out how to get children back to school so that parents can get back to work. And in many jurisdictions, including mine, schools are being treated as a kind of large gathering, which in some respects, of course, they are. They do bring a lot of people together. But that puts schools in a category of concerts or street fairs in terms of when we can safely do them again. And I think we can do without street fairs and without concerts for a long time. I don't think we should view all these things as having the same priority. You know, we've declared the meat supply in the United States a national emergency. I'm much more worried about the brain supply than I am the meat supply. And we need to apply all of American ingenuity, can-do attitude to figure out creative ways that we can get kids back before, as our first priority, and everything else can follow afterwards.
Well, putting children as a first priority is one thing that we definitely all agree on here. So there's so much to dig into. I also wanted to let both of you know that when we let listeners know that we were going to do this conversation, we got a lot of feedback from educators, from teachers, a lot of voicemails from folks saying that they are trying to right now do this work to prepare for, you know, a full menu of options for next year. Maybe in some schools, thinking they might have all the students back in the building at once, or different groups of kids alternating on different days, or an all remote learning scenario. So I want to just play some of the feedback we got from educators. James from Olean, New York, is particularly concerned about that last option, the all online option. He's a vocational education teacher, and he told us that while he and his students are trying their best, online instruction just does not work for his subject.
To just do worksheets online is just, we can't do that. I can't effectively train someone how to run a machine by doing a worksheet or watching a video.
But not everyone is sure that going back to in-person instruction in a classroom is the best idea. Kalyan from South Carolina told us that she has a hard time envisioning physical distancing in effect at her school. On a normal day before the pandemic, she said hallways were crowded and classrooms were filled with 30 students.
Kids are kids. They want to hang out. They want to talk. They run and, you know, play tag with one another. You can't separate them or keep them separate. It's nearly impossible.
Teachers also told us they are wondering how shrinking school budgets will change the school landscape this fall. Here's Clara, an art teacher in Brooklyn, New York. She worries that all the concerns about making up for lost instructional time in math and reading, those things that we test, Superintendent Brown, that might mean a reduction in opportunities like art classes, that they might even become an even lesser priority.
In my opinion, the enrichment opportunities like art and theater and gym are a real lifeline right now for students that aid and sustain their well-being and their social-emotional growth in ways that are going to help us get through this crisis.
All of our teachers, though, that reached out to us with their thoughts on this issue, they agreed on one thing without a doubt. They miss their students. Here's Heather, a fourth grade teacher who called us from Boston, Massachusetts.
I miss the kids so much, and I know that all of my colleagues feel the same way, and we would love nothing more than to go back to school and continue learning with the kids in person. I really hope that at some point next school year, we will be able to do that. Keeping that in mind, my number one priority is to make sure that all of the students are safe, and we will be putting every measure possible to ensure the safety and health of our community.
So those are the voices of some teachers who reached out to us when we asked the question of what will school look like in the fall. Well, joining us now is Randy Weingarten. She is the president of the American Federation of Teachers, a labor union that represents 1.7 million educators across the country. Randy Weingarten, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be with you, Meghna. And it's also great to hear Dr. Brown and Dr. Christakis. My sister, by the way, is an intensive care pediatrician in New York at Monte, and I really appreciated your comments, Doctor.
Mm. Well, so Randy Weingarten, tell us, where does the AFT stand on the reopening of schools come the fall? What's the union thinking?
So we actually have been working on this since the beginning of April and put out a 22-page document on April 29th about how to reopen schools safely, how to reopen school buildings, because as Dr. Brown and as the teachers who you just gave us tape of, they have changed virtually everything to try to do remote education, and with all of its limits, even though some kids have done well by it, with all of its limits, particularly the, lack of face-to-face contact, our members want to get back to school, provided that it is safe for families, for communities, and for them. And so we thought better to actually plan, not to wait for others to plan, but to plan ourselves and to engage parents and epidemiologists and doctors and others to help us with that planning. And so, you know, I sit on one of the planning committees in New York, the Cuomo Commission, about all of this stuff. And all the things that people have said are absolutely important. So we are leaning into not whether, but when. And mm-hmm. I just did a op-ed for the Washington Post about even using the summer, if we could get the resources, to try to road test some of the public health tools and education strategies we need. But what the three points I want to just really reiterate over and over again is that, and then this is in school taxonomy, Maslow beats Bloom right now, meaning we know that the instructional issues are really important, but we have to get to the primacy of the of well-being. And that's why teachers will tell you all the time, let's focus on Maslow first, and then let's focus on Bloom and do it with the lens that Dr. Brown just talked about, through equity and through ways of thinking about justice. And so we need to make sure that we do all the public health tools. But I agree with Dr. Christakos, sorry if I mispronounced it, that Christakis, thank you. That the that when you get, you need to have very low community spread. You need to have a testing, tracing, and isolation method in place, and infrastructure in place, so you can deal with any kind of spike. And then in schools itself, this is the most important thing I'm going to say. You need to make sure that the public health tools are there to limit or prevent the spread of the virus. At the very same time, we're marrying those public health tools to education strategies. Parents and teachers have to be involved, as well as school superintendents. Yeah. And the last point I'm going to make is this is going to cost more money, not less. Think about it this way.
Right.
Just even think about a model, because we have to get kids back to talking to each other, to playing with each other, to imagining with each other. That well-being issue is really important, and as is the secondary issue of for, because there's been a lot of essential workers that are going to work right now, but to reopen more of the economy, we need to make sure schools, you know, school buildings are open, but we also have a hybrid setting for people who are immunocompromised or for people who have COVID, are COVID positive, or for teachers who may be like 65 years old and have asthma like I do and are, you know, concerned about it. So I would say, let's throw out a model like this. Stagger the day. You have a group of kids going in the morning in elementary school, a group of kids going in the afternoon. You can do this by ability grouping, as Dr. Brown said, as opposed to by grade grouping. You can, you know, you create routines in classrooms. You do the kind of physical distancing so that there's half a class size. You can stagger the times that people so that the first grade, for example, goes to the buses 15 minutes before the second grade, and on and on. You can have food in classrooms. We can figure all of this stuff out, but it's going to cost money and it's going to mean planning. Yeah. And that's why the HEROES Act, the $1 trillion that Nancy Pelosi is trying to get to people, get to us, that's absolutely essential. But
right.
Let's put the models out. Let's do those kind of things. Let's get people involved in the planning.
Okay, so Randy Weingarten, you said a lot there, and I'm running out of time with you here because I've just got about a minute or so more with you. But practically speaking, I mean, you talked about tracing and contact tracing and testing needing to be in place. You talked about variable models. You talked about meeting children where they are in new ways, and you talked about how much all of this is going to cost. I mean, I think those are really, really important fronts, all of them. Practically speaking, as I see them all coming together, I'm thinking, how is that going to be possible? How is any of that possible to get it up and running in time for the fall? You said we can do this, but each one of those things are quite huge. There's obstacles in the way of each one of those things.
Right. But think about what just happened. In March, We just flew the plane. We built the plane and flew it in the same like 3 days. That's why the planning, just like when you have a new school, the planning has to happen now. Is it going to be perfect? It's not going to be perfect. That's why the public health rules become important. That's why I'm suggesting if people start seeing a model like one set of kids in the morning, one set of kids in the afternoon, mm-hmm. do we have the space to make that work? Can we do the cleaning yeah. in the middle of the day? If you start seeing that model, then a lot of these other issues start falling into place, with the exception of the money. Teachers want to do this.
Randy Weingarten, I'm afraid I've run out of time with you, but thank you so much for joining us today. Randy Weingarten is the president of the American Federation of Teachers. We'll get responses from Superintendent Brown and Dr. Christakis when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be taking a look at the challenges of people who suffer from substance abuse disorder and are seeking treatment during the coronavirus pandemic. How has physical distancing and stay-at-home recommendations changed or had an impact on folks who are suffering from those disorders? Has it been harder to get treatment in your community? So give us a call and tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about school and what school might look like in the fall. What should it look like if this is a chance, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to really reimagine education in America? And I'm joined today by Dr. Dimitri Christakis. He's a pediatrician and epidemiologist and director of the Center for Child Health, Behavior, and Development at Seattle's Children's Research Institute. And Luvelle Brown also joins us. He's superintendent of the Ithaca City School District in New York. And Superintendent Brown, you had a chance to listen to my quick conversation with Randy Weingarten of the AFT in the previous segment. And I would just want to start where she left off. I hear you when you talk about the opportunities that we have here to think about school in a completely different way. But does the reality of funding provide, I mean, is that an obstacle that'll be hard to overcome?
Well, thanks for asking. And it's always a pleasure to hear Randy talk. She's very familiar with my town as a Cornell graduate. Yes, funding is going to be an issue. It always is in our institutions. I've been doing this work now for 2 decades, and I can't think of a budget process that hasn't looked like us trying to find new efficiencies. And that's what we'll be doing now. We'll need to renegotiate contracts with our private industry that are providing services. We'll need to renegotiate our debt. As we look at capital improvements, we'll have larger class sizes. We'll need to use our technologies more efficiently. So yes, we've had budget crises before. This will be another one that we will need to negotiate. It will give us an opportunity to look at things as we haven't before. So yeah, I don't want to say I'm comfortable with having challenging conversations around budget, but we're used to that. And I think we'll navigate it carefully.
But the best I understand that even if you were to go back and just to sort of like do school as it was before, in order to maintain certain standards of health and cleanliness and distancing and safety, just grafting that on top of regular school would cost a lot more. So, I mean, we're talking about an unusually large budget crisis, aren't we?
Yeah, it will be unprecedented, no doubt. And it will change how we conduct business. Fewer young people in the building at a time will exponentially increase our transportation costs as we're trying to get young people to and from schools. So yeah, we're preparing for those things. It will be something unlike anything we've ever done before. It will require our most innovative thinking, but again, that's what we're here to do, is to do things that are unprecedented and challenging.
Okay. Dr. Christakis, this is another thing that Randy Weingarten said, which caught my attention. She talked about the need for, you know, getting testing and contact tracing up to speed for schools to fully reopen. We're quite a distance away from that, aren't we?
Yes and no. I mean, I wanted to say that it really saddens me to hear sound say that you know, he's going to have to do what schools have always had to do, which is do more with less. That shouldn't be the case. We've allocated $3 trillion, as far as I recall, maybe it's even four now, to quote-unquote try than investing in children. You know,
Dr. Krasakis, I'm just going to jump in here for a second because this is too important and your line keeps dropping out every few seconds. So I'm going to give my team in the studio a second to figure out how we can get you on a good line, because what you're saying is too important. So hang on here for just a second. Superintendent Brown, let me turn back to you. Okay. Here's what I want to know. I want to circle back to where you started about the opportunities here. Okay, so tell me more about the opportunities that you see, especially in regards to what you were talking about how some of the traditional ways we thought about school were doing kids no good to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, let's just take some terms that we've used for a long time and think about them differently. Anywhere, anytime, we've thought about that before, and quickly folks go to technologies and being able to provide instruction from anywhere and anytime. But let's think about a young person like myself, who was one of the few people of color in my community, and oftentimes the only person of color in the class. And that impacted my learning experiences. It impacted my achievement. Rarely having an opportunity to engage with an educator of color. We know the research is very clear that impacts young people of color who are attempting to learn. It impacts their achievement. We can now think about that differently. I could have access to a classroom or be in a class with people who look like me or thinking like me. I could have access to an educator who is of color, and how differently my educational experience could be. Standardization, we know we have the technologies that can be very diagnostic, but also adaptive to meet the needs of a learner where they are. So this notion of reading at grade level, what does that mean? A young person could engage with literacy in a culturally responsive way and learn at their pace, and get better based on the ways which our educators and our technologies can shift things. Family engagement, we're engaging with families now in ways we have not before. Before, there were families we did not have a parent-teacher conference with, or we didn't connect with because they weren't coming into our spaces. Now we must connect with those families to maintain contact, and we're using very innovative approaches to do so. So just thinking about equity and inclusion and access, we have an opportunity to rethink things we've been talking about for a long, long time. Anywhere, anytime, standardization of our curriculum, what does that mean? And family engagement, all things that can be and should be very different going forward.
Tell me a little bit more, if you could, about the standardization part, because, you know, as you rightly pointed out, like how we talk about things really matters. So are you saying standardization of curriculum is something that you want to leave behind, or something that
no doubt
that we should be thinking more of?
Okay. Yeah, we should. I mean, I would like for us not to use that word. I would like to use the word differentiated approaches to teaching and learning and instruction. Standardization means there's one standard, and that means there's one culture. And we know the culture that has traditionally achieved in our learning spaces, and all the other cultures have had to work hard to assimilate or to adapt. We know that the standard assessments are doing wrong by our young people of color and those living in poverty, just by the vocabulary that's being used in a standardized assessment. So just think about us assessing in a way that's more differentiated and culturally responsive. We have the technologies to do that. We have the talent in our educators to rethink and engineer those experiences for our young people as well.
What are you hearing from families, from parents? Are they excited about the opportunity to really rethink school here, or do they? I guess it's going to be both, right? Some will be on one camp, and others will be on others. But is there a deep desire to sort of to go back to school to the way it was, because it was working for a lot of kids.
Yeah, our families want the relationships. That's where the powerful teachers and educators are always going to be needed, because our families need those connections. So our people need that right now. And they need our talents to help engineer experiences for the young people that are going to better meet the needs of young people. I mean, our families have a behind the curtain look, under the hood look at all that we do now, these last 2.5 months. They have become the primary educators at home. So they now have an understanding and wishes about what we do that is different from the past. So they're going to be expecting more from us. They're going to be expecting us to differentiate more for their children. They're going to be expecting to have our schools cater to the individual familial needs and preferences. So I'm excited about that. Our families are engaging in ways that they have not before, and are going to be demanding much more from us than ever before.
Huh. Well, Dr. Christakis, do we have you back now?
I hope so. I apologize.
Okay, good.
One of my many technical challenges from working at home. Yeah.
No need to apologize. It seems like every moment of all of our lives is replete with technical challenges. So you were actually trying to make an important point before when you were responding to hearing Superintendent Brown saying that as per usual, he'll have to do less with more, or more with less, I should say.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know where I got cut off. I apologize if I repeat myself, but this is what school districts have always been asked to do. And you know, we've made a $3 trillion investment in trying to get through this crisis to date, I think. And what could be a more important use of those dollars than to provide schools with to focus on children and make them our priority? You know, this is a perennial challenge those of us that advocate for children face, because children don't vote, they don't make campaign contributions, and they're really treated too much as an afterthought. I don't think that Superintendent Brown or any school should be asked to do more with less. They're being asked to do an extraordinary job as it is, and now they're being asked to do an even more challenging one. They need that resource, and it should be an easy, easy thing. This isn't a political issue. I think everybody feels that schools are vitally important to children, and it should be an easy thing for us to allocate the necessary resource to make it happen. It saddens me that we're not doing that.
You know, Superintendent Brown has been talking about a vision of a future kind of school that is much more responsive to individual kids. And I am quite excited by that vision. But frankly speaking, I also think that we're a long ways off from there. Right now, we have some immediate information, for example, about how certain aspects of remote learning haven't been working for certain kids. Like I'll just reference right here in Boston, there was a report from the Boston Globe that said in the month of May, 10,000 students in the Boston public schools may have never logged on to school online resources even once for the month.
Right.
So we're seeing some of also the downsides of the sudden shifts that we've had to make.
We are. I mean, those data, I think, are generalizable to most of the country. In Seattle, 20% of African-American high school students in a recent report have not logged on at least once. It's horrible. I mean, the implications for that are so significant. And there are probably multiple reasons for it, including inadequate bandwidth, inadequate parental supervision, because many of their parents are having to work in this situation. So we're not meeting those needs. I do think, I mean, as I try to be optimistic, I think that there are some potential upsides to all of this in the long term if we learn how to leverage the challenges that we're facing now in creative and innovative ways in the future. But you're right, it's hard to do that in the midst of a crisis. But there will be lessons learned from this, and there will be, I think, some innovative strategies that we could deploy going forward if we ever have a new normal.
And I think leveraging what we've learning is exactly what Superintendent Brown has been encouraging us to think about. Superintendent Brown, I'm going to come back to you in just a second, but Dr. Christakis, there's a really fundamental question that I must ask that I think a lot of people listening are wondering why I haven't asked yet, because folks are wondering about immediate decisions that have to be made. Should school be staggered? Should kids be sitting 6 feet apart? Should there be plexiglass between sinks in the bathroom? Yeah. I mean, what should school look like physically?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's going to be lots of those things. You know, this is a very complicated problem, and it requires really a transdisciplinary approach. And what I called for in an editorial I wrote a month ago that sort of got me wading into this is that that's what's really needed. We need to bring together a really august group of experts to review everything that we know, given the limitations of what we'll know, because this is a fluid and evolving situation, and make the sort of best recommendations that put from the perspective of children for the fall. And that task force has now been impaneled. It's sponsored by the National Academy of Sciences. I have the distinct privilege of being a member of it, and we will be issuing our report in late June, early July, and hopefully that will be a useful resource for teachers and policymakers and parents as they face this really difficult decision about how to get children back to school as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I'm seeing here that this week the CDC has released some technical guidance on things to do in schools, face coverings, not sharing objects, maybe eating lunches in classrooms, that kind of thing. So we're starting to see the beginnings of that. Superintendent Brown, I imagine that you've already had to do a lot of thinking on that front for as and when you open your school buildings.
Yes, we have. And, you know, my blink reactions to the guidance that I've seen have been tough. Again, I lead a school district instructional space and not a correctional center. So I'm leery of us building and engineering situations where young people aren't feeling like they're included or not feeling like they're loved. But I also know that we must maintain safe environments for them as well. So we must strike a balance in these coming months and maybe potentially years.
I think that's so important. How kids feel in school, whatever school looks like, determines so much about what they get out of it, right? Absolutely. So we've got about a minute left. And Superintendent Brown, I'm going to give you the last word here. What do you need right now to help make great strides towards that sort of new, more responsive vision you were talking about for education? What do you need?
Well, thanks for asking. I need love. We need a culture of love right now. We need folks to be patient as we navigate these unprecedented situations and challenges. We need folks to be kind as we make mistakes. We're going to need them to be kind and forgiving. We need folks to be committed to this vision that I've laid out, for example. If we know what's best for young people, all young people, then let's stay the course and work towards that. Let's work towards building a more equitable organization. And we need folks to be humble. Humility right now is going to be needed more than ever as we're all learning together. Listening with one another, having conversations with one another, that humility and those other characteristics are going to lead to more loving communities and more loving organizations. Thanks for asking.
Well, Luvelle Brown is the superintendent of Ithaca City School District in New York. Superintendent Brown, thank you so much for joining us.
It was an honor.
And Dimitri Christakis, director of the Center for Child Health, Behavior, and Development at Seattle's Children's Research Institute. Thank you so much for joining us and reminding us about how important it is for the whole child for school to be thought through carefully. Dr. Christakis, thank you.
It was my pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.